Well, after last night's triumph with Brahms' Third Symphony and his first piano concerto, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe and Bernard Haitink complete their Brahms prom tonight with the Fourth Symphony, and they begin with the second piano concerto, Emmanuel Ax, again the soloist. In contrast to the response here yesterday evening, the audience at the premiere of the first piano concerto in 1859 had been scathing, and their reaction scarred Brahms deeply. As he remarked, the hissing was rather too much. Brahms remained wary of the piano concerto as a musical form, and it was 20 years before he attempted writing another. Happily, the second was a great success. His friend Theodor Billroth said the difference between the first and second concertos was like looking at the relationship of man to youth. Well, Manny Ax first performed that work when he was about 30. Bernard Haitink first conducted it around the same age, both men now able to bring decades more life experience to the music, and they have the benefit of many years working closely with each other. I asked the maestro what Emmanuel Ax brings to Brahms.
Oh, he's the ideal Brahms player. He has fantastic pianistic abilities because this is horrific difficult. He has the stamina, but he has the feeling for Brahms, the inwardness, the tenderness very often, and then all of a sudden, enormous outbursts, and he's a great musician.
Bernard Haitink. Well, Brahms started writing his second piano concerto while he was on holiday in Italy in 1878, but put the work aside in favour of a new violin piece. 3 years later, in 1881, he was back in Italy and finished what he started. He sent the score to Billroth with a note saying, "I'm sending you some little piano pieces." It turned out to be the four movements of this mighty concerto in B-flat major. It lasts almost an hour. And here to play it comes Emmanuel Ax together with Bernard Haitink, joining the Chamber Orchestra of Europe on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall for the Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2 in B-flat major.
Thank you.
Brahms Piano Concerto No. 2 in B-flat major, played by Emmanuel Ax. Bernard Haitink conducting the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. conductor and soloist, quick to clasp each other by the shoulder, but then instantly Emmanuel Axe insisted on bringing to his feet the cellist William Conway, who played that very beautiful theme in the slow movement. Well, Bernard Haitink and Emmanuel Axe, very different characters in terms of physicality. Haitink at 82, a little frail now. Axe, 20 years younger, enthusiastic, full of life, but both equally alert to the demands of the music. I was struck at this morning's rehearsal by the way that Emmanuel Axe barely looked at the keyboard. Instead, all he did was watch the orchestra intently, his ear cocked. He listened keenly, as though the attention should focus on the orchestra. He very much allowed the dynamics to influence his own, and he's back now on stage, being applauded by the orchestra, again patting the cellist William Conway on the shoulder and encouraging him to stand and shaking him warmly by the hand, and finally stepping forward to receive the applause himself. Seemed to be thoroughly enjoying himself at the keyboard, not at all exhausted by performing another concerto last night during the rehearsal this morning. And he's also been practicing all afternoon. I've been hearing him in the dressing rooms here at the Royal Albert Hall, and just beaming as he was listening to the orchestral parts as well as playing his own. Now coming back onto the stage, Bernard Haitink with his arm around Emmanuel Axe's shoulder. A wonderful collaboration between these two. And Bernard Haitink picking out a few other players who deserve some attention. The entire horn section, the first horn, Chris Parks opening this piece. And again, Bernard Haitink keen for William Conway to stand. And finally, encouraging all the players of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe to their feet. Ian Emmanuel Axe clasping hands and coming to the front of the stage here. And if you missed their performance last night at the first piano concerto, it's available on Listen Again in high quality audio via the Radio 3 homepage, bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. The Polish-born American Emmanuel Axe has been described by New York Times critic Paul Griffiths as a pianist of intelligent elegance. Pretty much sums up the performance here this evening. Absolutely packed Royal Albert Hall. They were turning people away very early on. Nobody else can fit into this arena. And the prom is very keen for Manny Axe to come back. And here he comes. Punching the air, a little gesture, applauding the orchestra. And I hope taking to the piano stool. No, he's not to be tempted. Teasing us a little, I think. He started studying piano when he was 6 years old in Warsaw. The family moved to North America in 1961, and he continued his studies at the Juilliard School. Bernard Haitink bringing him back on. Mm-hmm. Emmanuel Axe applauding the orchestra, they applauding him. Bernard Haitink again bringing the players to their feet. And just listen to those cheers. I wonder how many people here tonight were also here last night. A fantastic double bill of Brahms. Well, the Chamber Orchestra of Europe are devoting 2 years to performing Brahms under Haitink, part of their 30th anniversary. They're due to complete the cycle in Lucerne in the next few weeks, in fact, and they'll be ending this evening with Brahms' final symphony, his fourth. That's after the interval, and we join Anne McElvoy for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Hello and welcome to tonight's Proms Literary Event. We're very pleased to have with us Andrew Litton, who conducted an eclectic prom on Tuesday ranging from Bax to Bartok. He's currently both director and principal conductor of the Bergen Philharmonic Orchestra. He'll be known to many of you here for his recordings, including the Grammy winner Belshazzar's Feast with Bryn Terfel and the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, with whom he has a long-standing relationship. Tonight, though, he's going to be letting us in on his literary secrets. And we're very delighted to have a distinguished actor of stage and screen to read Andrew's choices for us. Charles Dance is one of the most prolific British actors, with a career spanning 40 years. He began illustriously as Toad of Toad Hall and went on to play many of the great Shakespearean roles. And that should stand him in good stead with some of Andrew's choices tonight. He's also got an extensive screen career behind him, which included being a Bond villain, as well as the award-winning TV series The Jewel in the Crown. If you would like to see what Charles looks like in full medieval leather bodywear, you can catch him as the villain Tywin Lannister in HBO's Game of Thrones. I should tell listeners, he has dressed down today. Ladies and gentlemen, Charles Dance. Now, Andrew, I notice the majority of the works that you've selected are classics. Does that mean you're keener on the classical canon than modern fiction?
Actually, the answer to that question is yes and no. Part of the problem is that most of what I read these days is not fiction. Well, let's say that they're biographies. They might be fiction, but they're not intentionally fiction. And so when I was asked to do this prom, of course, I always say yes to anything the BBC asks me to do, and then I think about it later. I realized that this was actually going to be quite a challenge because the works that, well, and the works that you'll see that I've chosen, represent really things that come all the way through my life. They're things that have influenced me in one way or the other, and that's what I used as my barometer for choosing the works that I've chosen. They aren't necessarily things I just read last week, with one exception. But they are very much things that I've grown up with and that I feel are very much part of who I am.
Well, the first work you've chosen is Shakespeare's Henry V, so let's hear Charles Dance read an abstract for us. Charles.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then should the warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, and at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, gentles all, the flat, unraised spirits that have dared on this unworthy scaffold to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram into this wooden O the very casks that did affright the air at Agincourt? Oh, pardon. Since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million, and let us, ciphers to this greater compt, on your imaginary forces work. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high uprearied and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our imperfections with your thoughts. Into a thousand parts divide one man and make imaginary puissance. Think when we talk of horses that you see them, printing their proud hooves in the receiving earth, for 'tis your thoughts that now must deck our kings. Carry them here and there, jumping o'er times into an hourglass for the which supply, admit me, chorus to this history, who prologue-like your humble patience pray, gently to hear, kindly to judge our play.
Thank you, Charles. Andrew, the language here is so thrilling, isn't it? In your day job, you must often focus on works that are written in foreign languages. So how do you appreciate English when you come back to reading an English text like that?
Well, that's actually why I chose this excerpt. It's only the second time in Shakespeare's entire output that he uses the device of the chorus, the other, of course, famously being in Romeo and Juliet. And to have this opening chorus as one of my excerpts is simply because I spend my day job, as you put it, listening to sounds, and especially, specifically, when we do opera or oratorio, the sounds of foreign languages, which often are absolutely beautiful, like French or Italian. And English isn't necessarily very high up on that list until you hear the words of Shakespeare spoken by a great British actor. And then suddenly you realize it's a very beautiful language. It's just how it's spoken and how it's written. And I just find the combination of words, I mean, basically, we could have said that in two lines. Okay, you're going to have to use your imaginations here, ladies and gentlemen. This is not, you know, we're not really going to show you any battles, and it's a kind of a small space, so enjoy the show. You know, and that's all he's just said. But oh my goodness, how much more beautiful the way Shakespeare puts it.
We're going to have a change of century and country now. You're of Russian extraction, and you've chosen the great Russian poet Pushkin in a work that's known as an opera and a literary classic. Would you like to tell us about this one?
Well, again, Eugene Onegin is what we're referring to, very famous opera by a certain Tchaikovsky. But one of the greatest moments of the opera, in fact, is Tatiana's letter scene. And I just also love it in the poem. I think it's an unbelievable bit of writing for showing really us at our most vulnerable, the confession of love, the sharing something that you really perhaps shouldn't share. And of course, as we do find out not too much later in the poem, she shouldn't have shared. She should have kept her mouth quiet. But therein the story would have ended, so I guess it's just as well that she did confess all this love and admiration for the title character. I just think it's beautiful. It's hard to imagine how different it must be in the native Russian. We were laughing backstage because this is actually a different translation than the one I was reading, but it's very similar. You know, how else do you try and capture the structure of the poem at the same time as making any sense in a different language? So it's, I think, one of the challenges that one faces with translations. But this is a very, very beautiful, heartfelt moment.
Let's hear Tatiana's letter from Pushkin's Eugene Onegin.
I write to you. No more confession is needed, nothing left to tell. I know it's now in your discretion, with scorn, to make my world a hell. But if you've kept some faint impression of pity for my wretched state, you'll never leave me to my fate. At first, I thought it out of season to speak, believe me, of my shame. You'd not so much as know the name if I'd possessed the slightest reason to hope that even once a week I might have seen you, heard you speak, on visits to us, and in greeting I might have said a word, and then thought day and night, and thought again about one thing till our next meeting. But you're not sociable, they say. You find the country God-forsaken. Though we don't shine in any way, our joy in you is warmly taken. Why did you visit us? But why? Lost in our backwards habitation, I'd not have known you. Therefore, I would have been spared this laceration. In time, who knows, the agitation of inexperience would have passed. I would have found a friend, another, and in the role of a virtuous mother and faithful wife, I'd have been cast. Another? No, another never in all the world could take my heart.
Charles Dance, thank you. Andrew, the beauty of that central scene comes through the translation very clearly there, doesn't it?
Very much so. And that has to be the ultimate love letter. And of course, doesn't end
well.
I won't
ask if you've ever used it.
No. Mine were usually three sentences, you know. Want to see a movie? No, just joking. It's just so beautiful. Actually, the three works that we're, you know, sort of middle of this list that we're in are all from the 19th century, and it dawned on me, and they're all basically 30 years apart in chronological order. So it struck me, because I think classical music always has lagged behind the other arts in its development, I'd say a good half a century. So really the area of music that I kind of specialize in is 1850 to the present. And the works I've chosen besides Shakespeare are basically 1830 to the present. So I thought that was kind of interesting that this really is, you know, I'm very much a product of the 19th century in many ways.
But what about the Russian element there? Because you do have this in your family background or on one side, I
think.
Well,
a very strong connection with all things Russian, both sides. So, you know, even though I'm as much a New Yorker as you possibly can be, grandparents and such were all from Russia. So it's both sides of the family.
Well, we're moving on to Revolutionary Paris next, and the best and the worst of times. So let's hear your next choice. It's Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities, and it's read by Charles Dance.
Such a staircase with its accessories in the older and more crowded parts of Paris would be bad enough now, but at that time it was vile indeed to unaccustomed and unhardened senses. Every little habitation within the great foul nest of one high building, that is to say, the room or rooms within every door that opened on the general staircase, left its own heap of refuse on its own landing, besides flinging other refuse from its own windows. The uncontrollable and hopeless mass of decomposition so engendered would have polluted the air even if poverty and deprivation had not loaded it with their intangible impurities. The two bad sources combined made it almost insupportable.
Thank you, Charles. So, Andrew, as a New Yorker, as you've just said, what attracts you to this great Victorian work set in London and Paris?
Well, I love Dickens, period. And you know, I was also toying with putting Great Expectations on this list. But the thing about A Tale of Two Cities, every school kid has to read it. It's required reading for studies of the French Revolution. And so way back when, it was an influential book to me. And when one goes back and rereads and sees the historical detail and just descriptive detail that Dickens provides, and that's why I chose this particular paragraph. I mean, what a description of poverty. It's unbelievable. It's so evocative and colorful and palpable. I mean, you can smell the smell off the page. Who writes like this anymore? I mean, this is fantastic stuff. And so, you know, that's why I guess I'm so stuck in the 19th century with these geniuses. You know, you read this stuff and you go, oh my goodness, this, how much more to the point, and yet in such a florid way can you be?
Well, I see you've plumped for another English writer next, for Oscar Wilde, not one of his more hilarious works. You've gone for Salome. It's a choice maybe based on opera in your case?
Totally based on opera. This one I decided, since I didn't go with Othello and with the Shakespeare, Othello, that I would not be so mindful in this case. This is a situation where I actually fell in love with the musical piece before the play. I got exposed to Strauss's Salome when I was very young. Fell in love with it immediately because, of course, it was very racy. It's still a very racy story, and you know, to a 10-year-old imagination, it was pretty raunchy stuff. And then when I grew up a bit, I actually, you know, studied the piece in great depth and realized what an amazing situation that a great composer didn't engage a librettist, but that actually just took the play and made some cuts, because music takes longer than words. But it's basically straight Wilde, and there's no greater endorsement, A, for a play's greatness, but B, for a composer's, the genius behind the composition of Strauss, is that he could set so completely the, shall we say, the scandalous world of this absolute, I chose a particularly colorful moment in the work, but the depictions of Oscar Wilde's characters, the way they talk to one another, it's truly the ultimate dysfunctional family. But it's also a situation where you realize that he is taking us into a world of sexuality and of adolescent wantings, longings that were very dangerous subjects 110 years ago and are still pretty dangerous now.
Thy body is hideous. It's like the body of a leper. It's like a plastered wall where vipers have crawled. Like a plastered wall where the scorpions have made their nest. It's like a whited sepulchre full of loathsome things. It's horrible. Thy body is horrible. It is of thy hair that I am enamored, Jokanal. Thy hair is like clusters of grapes, like the clusters of black grapes that hang from the vine trees of Edom in the land of the Edomites. Thy hair is like the cedars of Lebanon, like the great cedars of Lebanon that give their shade to the lions and to the robbers who would hide them by day. The long black nights when the moon hides her face, when the stars are afraid and not so black as thy hair. The silence that dwells in the forest is not so black. There is nothing in the world that is so black as thy hair. Suffer me to touch thy hair.
Thank you, Charles. Way to frizzle on that one, doesn't it? Well, we're going to move on to our final piece. Something of an unusual choice from Andrew and a bit of a challenge for our actor. Even one as multidimensional as Charles Dance is not often asked to play the satirist Tina Fey. Now, it's not quite Pushkin or Shakespeare, this, Andrew, but you came announcing that this is one of your choices with great glee.
I first of all, anybody who knows me knows that I love a good laugh. And, there's something so wonderfully irreverent about the way she talks, the way she writes, everything about her, really. And she has come to symbolize a side of my country now that I think is it's wonderful to share her work, because I feel that she's played an important role certainly in the last 4 or 5 years in a lot of the social thinking of our country. And this is just a very silly excerpt from her latest memoirs. Again, I wasn't supposed to pick nonfiction, but you know that Tina Fey is very often a lot about fiction.
Charles, for one night only, as Tina Fey.
For a brief time at the end of the last century, I was overweight. This is what I remember about that period. My boobs were bigger. I once left a restaurant in the middle of dessert to go to Krispy Kreme before it closed. Even though I only liked McDonald's fries, I believed it was more nutritious to make a meal of it and have 2 cheeseburgers as well. If I was really ambitious, I would get a Whopper Jr., a Burger King, and then walk to McDonald's to get the fries. The shake could be from anywhere. I could not run a mile. I wore oversized men's overalls that I loved. Guys who were friends with me did not want to date me, and I hated them for it. On at least 3 occasions, I vomited on Christmas Eve. From mixing chocolate, peel-an-inch shrimp, summer sausage, and cheese. No alcohol was involved. As a size 12, I took pride in the idea that I was a real woman. Size 12 is the national average, I would boast, no matter what magazines try to tell you. Once, while ironing my underwear, I grazed my protruding belly with a hot iron. We should leave people alone about their weight. Being chubby for a while, provided you don't give yourself diabetes, is a natural phase of life and nothing to be ashamed of. Like puberty. Or slowly turning into a Republican.
Charles Dance performing at this evening's Proms Plus event, where Anne McElvoy spoke to the conductor, Andrew Litton, about his literary passions. The producer was Gavin Hurd. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and this BBC Prom, celebrating this season's focus on Brahms and the 30th anniversary of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. Last night, Bernard Haitink conducted them in Brahms' Third Symphony, and they end tonight with his fourth. I was interested to know how long Bernard Haitink has been a Brahms devotee, so I asked him about his early encounters with Brahms.
My first contact with music was during the years of the occupation in Holland, between 1940 and 44, 45. And even there I heard my first promenade concerts. It was highly risky because we were not allowed to listen to the radio, especially not to London. And mostly it was disturbed with the Germans. But strangely enough, I have some memories, and some very, for me, important memories. I believe that I heard the debut of Ida Handel with the Brahms Violin Concerto. And I believe that I heard the last concert of Sir Henry Wood with Beethoven 7. That was all in 1944. And since then, music was all the time in my life.
And you're culminating tonight in the performance of Brahms' Fourth Symphony. What's special about that piece for you?
Well, listen, Brahms is such a strong personality, strong musical personality, that every of the four symphonies has a character of its own. But of course, it's totally different and has this typical Brahms character, that he goes back to, for example, the Chaconne at the last movement, this incredible 8 bars who come back all the time, that gives the piece an enormous seriousness. And it is difficult to interpret because when you are too easy with the tempo, with the Chaconne all the time, then it becomes boring and you have to keep the dramatic feeling.
It's a symphony that, it seems to me, has quite a tight classical structure, and yet within it the music is very full of passion, full of yearning in places.
Yeah, that is the important thing in Brahms.
Bernard Haitink. Well, the Fourth Symphony begins conventionally enough with a sonata form allegro, followed by a moderate slow movement. Third comes a powerful scherzo, almost a finale in its own right, and for the final movement, Brahms takes the theme from Bach's cantata number 150, coming up with no fewer than 32 variations, each more complex than the last. In the score, the movement's marked energico e passionato and makes prominent use of the trombones. Well, Bernard Haitink was telling me earlier about the sheer pleasure of performing Brahms with a chamber rather than a symphony orchestra, partly because the Chamber Orchestra of Europe have exactly the same number of players as Brahms' own orchestra in Meiningen. Well, here comes Bernard Haitink returning to the platform here at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct Brahms Symphony No. 4, bringing the Chamber Orchestra of Europe to their feet before getting them to sit. Stephen Johnson says in tonight's programme that the defiant joy that permeates the darkness of that ending puts him in mind of Dylan Thomas's words, "Time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea." That was Brahms' Fourth Symphony, Bernard Haitink conducting the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. He shows extraordinary humility as a conductor, quickly stepping down off the podium to shake hands with the leader, Marika Blankenstein, and then with everyone on the front desk. And back on the platform now, putting his hand to his heart and encouraging the first horn to stand. And the flautist Ingrid Geerlings. And the oboist Kai Frumgen. And going through all of the woodwind, the clarinets, Roman Guyot, and the bassoon, Matthew Wilkie, and the three trombones, and the trumpets now, and the timpanist, and bringing all of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe to their feet. He says, conducting them isn't work, it's pure pleasure. Well, I don't know if you heard Tom Service yesterday in the interval of last night's prom, talking about the myth of Brahms as a brown composer steeped in those muted colours of the Victorian drawing room. Well, there was nothing muted about that performance. Fantastic vibrancy of orchestral colour and great clarity in their performance. He was saying to me earlier today, Bernard Haitink, that he loves the transparency of the way these players perform, and particularly the way they listen to each other. And he certainly has plenty of experience conducting bigger orchestras. He was chief conductor of the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra until 1988. He's now their conductor laureate. He's very much an icon in his native Holland. Pretty much an icon at the Proms here too. All of the players applauding him as he makes his way back onto the platform. And if you enjoy Brahms, Brahms' first symphony is being performed on Monday here at the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC Symphony Orchestra. Tomorrow, being Sunday, there's a big choral work on the programme. It's Mozart's Requiem, Stephen Layton conducting polyphony, and the City of London Symphonia, and the soloists are Emma Bell, Renato Prokopic, Ian Bostrich, Roderick Williams, and James Rutherford. That prom begins with Britten's Variation on a Theme of Frank Bridge, and the world premiere of No Man's Land by Colin Matthews. That's tomorrow at 7 o'clock on Radio 3. Bernard Haitink coming on now, trying to get the players to stand. Eventually, they're obliging. They're off to Lucerne to conclude their Brahms cycle there. But what an impression they've made with their double set of proms. All of Brahms' music here at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, it's time now to hand you over for the rest of this evening's listening here on Radio 3 to Jonathan Swain.
Louise, thank you. Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday afternoon. That's this coming Monday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 at 2 o'clock. Well, back to this evening, and in just over 10 minutes, our music feature. In the current economic climate, some British cultural organisations are looking to America in search of ideas for fundraising. The received opinion is that America's the great shining example of private and philanthropic sponsorship of the arts. But wasn't always the case. There was one brief period when President Franklin D. Roosevelt initiated centralised arts funding from scratch. And in our feature, Nicholas Heitner investigates those five golden years in New Deal America, when music and the arts flourished. That's at 10:15 this evening. Until then, back to Brahms. I do hope you haven't got Brahms fatigue. This is Brahms from soprano Margaret Price, much missed since she died earlier this year. Her many recordings include quite a few song recitals with pianist Graham Johnson. And from one of them, these are settings Brahms made over the years of poems by Heinrich Heine. The third and fourth were, in fact, conceived by Brahms as companion pieces. Sommerabend, Summer Evening, and Mondenschein, Moonlight, the moon a central figure in both, and they share musical ideas too. Moonlight in this first of the songs too, Meerfahrt, a sea journey. We sat together in the boat, the island of ghosts lay in the moonlight, where music was sounding and the mist danced. The Bay of Venice, perhaps, the Lido being the island of ghosts. All sounds very idyllic, doesn't it? Except for the last line, we, inconsolable, drifted past upon the wide sea.
Thank you.
Brahms, setting poems by Heinrich Heine, that last one, Mondenschein, Moonlight. The singer was Dame Margaret Price, and the pianist Graham Johnson, part of a disc of Brahms songs they made in 1992. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 9:45. Well, our evening feature now presents a second chance to hear a public right and obligation in which the National Theatre's artistic director Nicholas Heitner looks at an experiment in America when the economic crisis of the 1930s gave a huge boost to music making. He explores a forgotten moment in cultural history and in the process uncovers an unexpected treasure trove of broadcast gems.
Rodgers and Hammerstein's musical Carousel is amongst the highest achievements of the American commercial theatre. It had its first production on Broadway in 1945. I directed Carousel at the National Theatre in 1992, which you might assume is the closest American music making gets to state subsidy. But in this programme, we'll be exploring a fascinating moment in American cultural history, which for a few brief years pointed the way towards an entirely new form of arts funding. With core arts funding suffering its biggest cut in decades, cultural organisations in this country are being asked to look to America for funding models based largely on private philanthropy and corporate sponsorship. But in the aftermath of the last financial cataclysm in the 1930s, America pioneered a very different form of state subsidy of the arts. During the Great Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt created the Works Progress Administration, or WPA. Its focus was to find work for those without jobs, and that included unemployed artists. European art subsidy evolved from a centuries-old tradition of church and court patronage, but in the American context, what Roosevelt was doing was truly radical.
There was absolutely no centralized federal support for the arts. You know, all the major orchestras and opera houses had been privately funded from the beginning. So suddenly, in 1935, people are trying to figure out how could we have such a system. And it's just not easy to invent a cultural bureaucracy absolutely from scratch.
The money that was invested in these musical ensembles went far and wide. It's a pretty vast program. It would take an effort, possibly the size of the WPA, to reconstruct what the WPA did for music.
What they were trying to do was create an American idiom. And so the experiments tended to focus on how to build an audience, how to build an audience out of the working class.
Thank you.
That was the music of Randall Thompson, Paul Bowles, and Virgil Thompson, all composing in the American idiom. During the years 1935 to 1939, the American government ran Federal One, the cultural program of the WPA. What was extraordinary was that they didn't play safe by funding existing organizations only. Instead, the new government arts projects also produced their own programs and were committed to developing new work.
The White House, Washington, May 1937. In its universal appeal to all classes, music exerts a strong influence for enriching our culture and for bringing happiness into our lives. It is my hope that those interested in the development of music as a national cultural asset will take advantage of the opportunity not only to present programs of high quality to the general public, but also to provide community programs that will aid in the discovery and development of local music talent. During the brief periods in which we give music an opportunity to dominate our consciousness, we experience pleasures that lift us above the commonplace and into the realms of the ideal. Very sincerely yours, Franklin D. Roosevelt.
It was an extraordinary period in American musical history.
The New Yorker's music critic, Alex Ross.
The actual tangible results of it were not quite as substantial as the idea of it and the sort of spirit of it, because it simply didn't have a chance to really grow and take root, because it was cut off after only a few years for political reasons. It ended up almost sort of vanishing into thin air in a certain sense, but you can see hear the echoes of it all through musical history in America right up to the present day.
The composer who came to be the popular representation of the new democratic and anti-elitist spirit in music was Roy Harris. He was a model of the kind of composer that the government wanted to support. Prolific, a great teacher, generous to his peers, and active in the community. He had his own radio show called Let's Make Music. He was also born in a log cabin in Oklahoma on Lincoln's birthday.
Harris' Third Symphony is a wonderfully vital expression of the spirit of this period, this kind of robust music with broad shoulders and striding across the open plain. And there were a lot of pieces that were sort of seeking that quality, and most of them haven't lasted. And Harris himself actually tried to imitate that tone in a whole series of subsequent works and never quite was able to repeat the feat. The Third Symphony, it is, I think, America in 1938. Not so much the reality of this very complicated moment in American history, but the ideal.
The claim at the time was that 95 million people heard 136,000 concerts in the first 18 months of Federal One. At its peak, the Federal Music Project supported 16,000 musicians and operated 125 orchestras, 135 bands, and 32 choral and opera units. In this program, we'll look at how it stimulated audiences, boosted music education, and gave a platform to American composers like Roy Harris. Alex Ross's book, The Rest Is Noise, is a thrilling history of the music of the 20th century. His chapter on the WPA is fascinating. The Federal One scheme covered five projects: writing, art, theatre, music, and a historical records survey. The music project got the biggest slice of the total budget.
Here we have this vast sum of money, more than $7 million. Let's spread it in big cities and in smaller towns. There was a wonderful spirit of reaching out to minorities, of encouraging African-American musicians, women, as well as men, as composers. This whole idea of orchestras for the people, opera for the people, lowering ticket prices, you know, one concert after another, one event after another, where thousands of people sort of materialized to hear music that they never heard before.
We don't yet know the full impact of the current budget cuts in Britain. The National Theatre and other large metropolitan entities may be able to weather the storm. But if subsidies are withdrawn from smaller regional venues, it's likely that the impact on the development of local talent will be disastrous. It's interesting that the guiding principle of FDR's Federal Music Project was that although it was centrally administered, it insisted that local orchestras should promote local musicians and local music. Small orchestras got to play for the nation for the first time on government-sponsored radio programs.
At this time, the Works Progress Administration offers a program by the Saxophone Sextet of Boston, a unit of the Federal Music Project, which is under the direction of Dr. Nikolai Sokolov. The program opens with this novelty group conducted by Pearly Stevens, featured in The Russian Rag by Cobb. The American Spirit March. And in the American spirit, the Work Project Administration presents another in its series of transcribed programs. Today's music is furnished by the Illinois WPA Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Jose Ecanes. The orchestra opens the program with the overture to Abu Hassan, the opera which depicts many events in the life of its composer, Carl Maria von Weber.
At this time, the Work Projects Administration presents a transcribed program by its American folk singers, directed by Thomas Johnson. This is a unit of the Massachusetts WPA Music Project. With great spirit and pride, the singers open with, I Got a Robe.
I got a robe.
You got a robe.
Oh, don't you know, robe.
Oh, no.
When I get to heaven, I'm gonna put on my robe. I'm gonna shout all over the town.
Oh, no, heaven, oh, no, heaven.
Everybody talk about a heaven made of going there, heaven.
One of the most moving things that I found in my researches for the New Deal chapter of The Rest is Noise was an account of an event that took place in Oklahoma in a town called Boley, which was a mostly African-American population. And here the local report from the Oklahoma branch of the Federal Music Project says, the highlight of Music Week observation for the teaching project was the statewide Negro Music Festival, which was held at Boley, the Negro metropolis of Oklahoma. An outstanding feature of this festival was a musical parade in which over 1,000 pupils participated. Flags, banners, placards, and gay streamers added color to the parade, which was made doubly interesting by musical selections, which were dramatized by choruses and class groups as they marched to the music of three bands, which gives you a wonderful sense of almost kind of a Charles Ives spectacle of all these sort of different musical groups colliding in the streets of the city. But of course, much more movingly, the idea that here the federal government was stepping in and supporting cultural expression by African Americans, and really in the deepest sense, music for all the people, as the slogan of the time went.
1937, The Nation. Music for music's sake has been the aim of the Federal Music Project. Founded because of the musician's plight, its emphasis has been on performance and on teaching. Chiefly, the FMP has given music back to the people, as the Federal Theater has given back the living stage. Thus, it is not uncommon to hear Brahms wafted by a string quartet from the backyard garden of a settlement house.
For the musicians and for the Federal Music Project, the idea was for them to work.
Kenneth Bindus, professor of history at Kent State University in Ohio, has written the only detailed study of the Federal Music Project in print. No event was too small, and no audience too unlikely for a concert. Musicians performed in concert halls, and they marched in parades, but they played for the community wherever they were invited. Concerts were often free, but the highest ticket price was 50 cents.
This was a work project. This wasn't a sit-in-a-studio project and rehearse, rehearse, rehearse. They took whatever gig came up. They would perform anywhere and everywhere, and they did. Grocery store openings, homes for the blind, homes for the aged, grade schools. They participated in every music festival. In San Antonio, they participated in the Texas Centennial. They performed at baseball games and at football games and lunches for the Daughters of the American Revolution, anywhere and everywhere.
The Albany Symphony Orchestra, which was founded in 1930, playing a contemporary composer, William Schumann.
More than anything, the lasting effect for the Federal Music Project, one of the more important lasting effect, was the creation of orchestras throughout the United States and the rejuvenation of orchestras throughout the United States. As a result of the Federal Music Project, towns like Bridgetown, Connecticut would have a symphony, or Lynn, Massachusetts, or Akron, Ohio, or Jackson, Mississippi, Richmond, Virginia, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. These were places where the Federal Music Project created orchestras, and then when the Federal Music Project ended and when World War II ended, those orchestras remained part of the community and remain part of the community still to this day. In other places, they saved orchestras from going under and supported them during the hard times of the Depression, and then afterwards, they too became private entities that survived to the day, like Toledo, Ohio, Portland, Oregon, Syracuse, New York, San Diego, California, you know, Buffalo, New York. These towns wouldn't be unable to support these orchestras during the 1930s, they would have gone under and probably not been resurrected after 1945. So the Federal Music Project provided that bridge between the Depression and World War II and the post-war prosperity. We'll be right back.
FDR delegated well. He put the charismatic administrator Harry Hopkins in charge of the work relief scheme, and then Hopkins in turn picked the heads of the arts projects.
Certainly Franklin Roosevelt gave Harry Hopkins the ability to do with the WPA as he saw fit. And within the WPA, Harry Hopkins pretty much gave Nikolai Sokolov permission to do what he saw fit.
New York Times, 4th of November, 1935. Dr. Sokolov's outline of the work of the Federal Music Project is far-reaching. It extends in its ministrations from the unemployed piano tuner to the prospective music librarian. Very firmly, this plan stands against giving a musician, merely because he is unemployed, work which he is not able properly to do. When a person claiming the title of musician appears before the examiners and his limitations are revealed, he is told to go back on home relief.
Sokolov made it clear that he was promoting what he called cultivated music. He believed that it was the public's right to hear uplifting music, and it was the government's obligation to raise the musical IQ of its citizens. His approach was very different from the feisty Hallie Flanagan. She ran the Federal Theatre Project and was outspokenly political and encouraged experimentalism, while Sokolov focused on the task of getting musicians jobs. At the time of his appointment in 1935, 70% of musicians in America were out of work.
Dr. Nikolai Sokolov. All of us are aware that our skills as musicians are subject to deterioration more rapidly than those of other professional workers. And because we are musicians, we possess sensitivity more acute, perhaps, than other folk. More than 17,000 musicians came to the Federal Music Project for retraining and for the chance to keep bodies and souls together within their craft. Many of them were bitterly skeptical. Their morale was lamentably low. These musicians responded promptly, however, when they were convinced that honest standards of musicianship were expected of them, and when they learned that they were expected to return a value to their communities so that music would be retained as a part of permanent civic programs, and thus they would find security in employment.
Sokolov gave priority to musicians who were classically trained.
The American Federation of Musicians and popular musicians were upset by the Federal Music Project because there was a very rigorous audition one had to pass in order to become a member of the Federal Music Project, to become a musician, and it favored cultivated music over vernacular. So if you were a popular musician who played swing music or jazz or blues or hillbilly music, you couldn't pass the audition.
New York Times, December 1935. Your clothing is frayed, and your heels are run down. You have not eaten well in a very long time, and now you must lift your voice and you must sing soaringly. If you do not, the four judges will turn their thumbs down, and for you there will be no relief from the musician's emergency aid. No audition is easy, but this one, which is held weekly in the Steinway Concert Hall, is the toughest of them all. And there are eight who have come at 9:30 in the morning, desperate and destitute, to brave it. Sopranos, pianists, a cellist. They sit in the foyer, nervous, aloof, awaiting their call.
This program, presented by the Federal Music Project of the Works Progress Administration, has been performed by musicians taken off relief rolls and put to work by WPA to maintain their musical skill as well as to provide education and entertainment for the general public. We suggest that you visit your local WPA projects.
The Federal Music Project, like all the New Deal agencies, was very, very aware of publicity. Roosevelt understood that his government was not supported as strongly as one might imagine. He believed that the press, particularly the newspaper press, was not in his corner. And he used the radio more than anything else to really push the advantages of the New Deal. And a federal music project, for example, performed over 8,000 times on the radio between 1935 and 1940. These were performances where they blended traditional American music like John Philip Sousa and Stephen Foster with some newer compositions. These type of shows would be 15-minute feeds, and then after that would be another show about another aspect of the WPA.
This famous band, known as the President's Own, is presented by the Work Projects Administration of the Federal Works Agency. Victor Herbert's Festival March.
Sokolov didn't expect all the compositions to be highbrow. Jonathan Higham is curator of the American Music Collection at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts.
Victor Herbert is one of these performers who knows his audience. He is not an aloof character. He has not distanced himself from them. He's a performer. He could also be thought of as an entertainer. He's of that tradition of big stage performance, and he makes music for the people. There's quite a few of these characters in the early to mid-20th century that sort of usher in what we now think of as this kind of golden age of classical music in the United States, which is relatively short-lived, but people still pine after.
The head of the publicity wing of the Federal Music Project was a fellow by the name of Harry Hughes, and Harry Hughes was constantly sending letters and memos out to state directors and local directors for news stories. Send us news clippings, send us transcriptions of radio broadcasts, send us everything and anything you have, and we'll send it out to the media through the office in Washington, D.C. So they really had a very elaborate publicity machine as part of this.
Thus we bring to a close this transcribed program with the famous United States Marine Band under the leadership of Captain William F. Santelman, Henry Weber's second leader conducting. Through the cooperation of the United States Marine Corps with the Work Projects Administration, this program has been presented for the education and entertainment of the public. Miss Lucy Monroe, known from coast to coast as the Star Spangled Soprano, is doing her bit for national defense by organizing community sings and speaking on her favorite subject, patriotism and music. Miss Monroe.
First of all, I'd like to thank the WPA and this radio station for giving me the opportunity to tell you people how I feel about the Star Spangled Banner. And in return for this opportunity, I'd like to go on record as saying that, in my opinion, the WPA and radio are responsible between them for bringing more good music to more people than any other agency in history.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light.
Not content with writing public service announcements in the breaks between music tracks in the radio shows, the Hughes PR team got quite creative.
My favorite is the one in Louisiana, where Rene Solomon, who was the state director in Louisiana and New Orleans, told a story about how he went to a project. It was a WPA project where they were digging ditches. During lunchtime, this small concert band performed for the workers while they ate their lunch. And one of the songs they played was part of an opera, and one of the workers, a bigger fellow, stood up and started to sing along with the band, which Rene Solomon stopped the orchestra and said, you know, what are you doing? And the guy said, you know, before the Depression, I was training to be an opera singer. And then the Depression came, and now I'm forced to dig ditches for my family. So Solomon got him an audition for the Federal Music Project, but that's not the end of the story, because then when Solomon told the story to Harry Hughes, Harry Hughes immediately sent his publicity team and his propaganda team to write a radio script where they made it so that it happened on the night before Christmas and he didn't have any money for any gifts for his children. And so at this moment when he stood up and started to sing, he was immediately taken into the Federal Music Project, and immediately his family had a wonderful Christmas and everybody benefited from it.
It's interesting that in the same period of this brief flirtation with government support for the arts and for music in particular, we also had classical music being very strongly promoted on the radio. Toscanini conducting the NBC Symphony and some very interesting programs happening on the CBS network. And this idea of those running the commercial radio networks, that they had some kind of responsibility to support this music.
At the New York Public Library, music librarian Jonathan Higham came up with a discovery: a box of government-produced radio broadcasts, which he didn't know they possessed.
When your team came in to investigate some of the WPA here in the New York Public Library, we were excited to sort of investigate what we might have with sound recordings. So if you wouldn't have come and looked, this may not have been something that we dug too deeply to find. I thought we might find transcription discs, in other words, you know, forms of technology that were really kind of test discs or things that were recorded that weren't necessarily meant to be distributed, but to find discs that really seemed to have had the purpose of being disseminated, that was a surprise to me. And it's clear that some work needs to be done to figure out exactly what was going on here. They're 16-inch discs, they're black, and there's a big red, white, and blue label in the middle that says Federal Music Project, and then it says Works Projects Administration, and then it lists the ensemble, a speaker. They all seem to have the same format, which is two pieces with some spoken matter before and in the middle. So clearly there was a kind of design and a production element to this.
The New York Library for the Performing Arts itself owes a huge debt to the Federal Music Project, Higham explained. In 1931, it appointed an innovative head of music.
He was able to create something that we call the Black Line Project. In other words, he took older scores of music that were not performable in their current state and had a whole series of copyists come in and create performance editions so that the music could then be performed. And the library also hosted the Composers Forum Laboratory for quite a while, which was funded through the WPA.
Copying music provided a worthy occupation for many, but wasn't headline-grabbing. But the Composers Forum Laboratory was an innovative institution with many local branches. The music at these events wasn't recorded, but transcripts of the conversations with the audience were. It was expected of a composer to answer his critics. That was part of the commission, a feeling that this was part of the public right and obligation, that you had to have a direct exchange with your audience and be able to articulate your ideas. Newcomers and women got the brunt of the questioning.
Excerpt from a Composer's Forum transcript with Johanna Beyer, May the 20th, 1936. Miss Beyer, if your work is indicative of contemporary trends in music, where, oh, where do we go from here? Thanks for the compliment. Miss Beyer, in listening, are you conscious of the fact that the tone clusters in your two piano works present such a conglomerate mass of tone, that the effect is merely one of disorganized sound, i.e. chaos? Have you heard this played? Yes, I heard it played tonight. And I believe if you would hear it again or more often, you would be able to find something else in it besides noise and so on. Miss Beyer, you seem to have gone your male preceptors one better in search for strange and ineffective tonal combinations. Have you consciously adopted Rudyard Kipling's statement, "The female of the species is deadlier than the male," as a guiding principle in your composition? Miss Beyer bowed graciously, and the audience laughed.
One composer who didn't need the FMP was Aaron Copland. First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, was one of the earliest prominent figures to narrate Copland's Lincoln portrait and fanfare. She actively promoted her husband's federal arts projects.
Mrs. Roosevelt certainly was a key component to it, but I think there was an attitude amongst many within the Federal Music Project and the WPA in general that women needed to be folded better into the unemployment relief process that had begun in 1933. Women were employed as conductors, composers, musicians, and oftentimes played in sexually integrated orchestras for the first time. Oftentimes, they were the first chairs in violin or cello and other instruments. Also, it was the Federal Music Project that, to a large degree, encouraged women composers.
Like Ruth Crawford Seeger. Here's her 1932 song, Sacco and Vanzetti, commemorating the infamous trial of immigrant anarchists.
Petitions, protests, telegrams, demonstrations, strikes. Oh, they bury fire, the cold ashes of our two martyrs, but they can never soften the murderous heart. Tears, sighs, complaints, and the like.
Some African-American composers got a break, but Sokoloff's emphasis on cultivated music meant that he tolerated spirituals and jazz only as hooks and themes incorporated into classically influenced work as a way of building an audience. William Grant Still was the first African-American to conduct a major symphony orchestra. Overall, the music project was the least controversial of the funded arts projects, which is why it's been underexplored.
It's just not as sexy as the other projects because it doesn't have a Jackson Pollock. It didn't do radical living theater. It was cultivated music, and that's kind of traditional.
There was some collaboration between the music and the theater projects. Virgil Thompson was the musical director of Orson Welles' Voodoo Macbeth, featuring Haitian drummers and a witch doctor. And FMP composer Mark Blitzstein wrote his pro-union musical The Cradle Will Rock for the 22-year-old Wells in 1937. The Broadway theatre they were to perform it in was shut down by the authorities, and the cast in protest performed in the auditorium of a vacant theatre nearby.
Scene 3, a mission, 1915.
My dear Mrs. Mister.
Reverend Powell!